Andy Moss Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. The Midwest is parched this summer, the result of a severe drought. Charles Fishman wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week about how we can use this drought as an opportunity to think more creatively about water. Fishman was a guest on Radio Times last year when his book, The Big Thirst, was first published. We were intrigued with the article that he wrote last week and invited him to join us on Radio Times. And Charles Fishman, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be back.
Nice to have you back. Let me put some basic stuff on the table and ask you just a couple of questions. Looking at Americans, the typical individual American, how much water do we use in a day?
A typical American uses 99 gallons of, you know, actual water on average per person. You know, that's for drinking and making coffee, but also for running the dishwasher, running the clothes washer, and of course, flushing the toilet.
Indeed, and I'll get back to all of that. Looking at industry, looking at energy plants, agriculture, how much water do those use?
Well, it's kind of amazing. The electricity that we all use, electricity generation uses 49% of the water used every day. Half the water in the country goes to electric generating plants. So while a typical American uses about 100 gallons of water at home per person, the electricity that we use just at home, each of us, requires 250 gallons of water. So one good way of saving water, in fact, is to turn off the lights, turn off the, don't let the flat screen TV rest in, you know, on mode when you turn the cable box off. We use twice as much water every day at home for the electricity as we do for the actual water. So energy requires half the water the country uses every day. Agriculture requires about 30%, and the rest goes to a big industry that's not on a water utility and residential and ordinary commercial use.
Well, let me ask you about this thing called infrastructure where people's eyes glaze over. But nonetheless, and it's been true here in Philadelphia in the summer, there have been some water main breaks. How much water do we lose through our pipes?
Well, it's kind of sad. Cities struggle to make sure they have enough water, and that's really clear, of course, in a drought. But the big cities in the U.S. lose 1 out of 6 gallons of water that they pump. So a city like Philadelphia is a perfect example. The leak rate in Philadelphia is 16%, 17%. Philadelphia gets the water, takes it into the system, cleans it, stores it, pumps it out into the water main. So it's gone to all that trouble, all that expenditure of effort and energy, and then loses it between the water treatment plant and the home or the business. It seeps back out of the pipes. 1 gallon out of 6. So imagine if Steve Jobs, if Apple destroyed 1 iPhone of every 6 it made, just threw it in the garbage. So we're losing literally a whole day's water every 6 days for the whole country because the pipes are old and they leak and they're not well maintained and they're invisible. And Philadelphia, in fact, but this is true in New York, it's true in Miami, it's true in Dallas and Minneapolis. Philadelphia is a city where the city water department struggles to get the resources to replace the pipes that are in the ground. They want to. And then, believe it or not, cities often struggle to get political support. People don't want their road ripped up to replace water pipes that they never look at. And so the water system works brilliantly, but it's also very neglected.
And that's Charles Fishman. We are talking about a piece that he wrote last week in the New York Times, an op-ed looking at how we waste water and perhaps how we can think more smartly, more creatively about water. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Charles, you have a couple of interesting suggestions. One is something called smart plumbing. It makes sense. We have, you know, smart houses, smart phones, things like that. What would smart plumbing do?
This is my own inspired idea that I wish somebody would grab hold of.
Well, we're all ears.
I wish that our shower faucets, our toilets, our kitchen spigots, the faucet in your bathroom where you brush your teeth and shave, had little digital readouts that told you how much water you were using right at the moment, how much that spigot has put out today and this week and this year, if you think about the miles per gallon meters in your car, we've all got those on the dashboard now. I love it. It changes the way I drive, frankly. And when I'm driving badly, I even like it then because I know exactly how badly I'm driving. There's no reason that plumbing couldn't have similar kinds of readouts. And commercial plumbing, of course, has that kind of stuff. You know, in big factories, they know how much water they're using every second. But there's no reason your shower couldn't have a beautifully designed little gauge built in. And frankly, I'd like to know how much water my son's shower took. And if I could pit my son and my daughter against each other, I think we'd see our water use go down dramatically. The plumbing companies don't, for some reason, it hasn't occurred to them to provide that kind of fixture, but they easily could, and it would actually be fun, and it would have a great impact.
You also talk about thinking about recycling water, using storm water or wastewater, and recycling that water to the point where we could actually drink it.
Well, the plumbing fixtures is a way of raising consciousness and changing home habits a little bit, but that's the big picture. The big picture is managing stormwater so that it's not a burden, but it's an asset. You think, boy, look at all this water. Let's, instead of dumping it in the river, let's collect it and use it for outdoor lawn watering. Let's use it to recharge aquifers. Central Florida, for instance, the county that contains Orlando, Orange County, Florida, has had a reuse system for 25 years. Nobody who lived in Central Florida in 1983 had to put in the reuse system. But every home and business built since 1983 has a second plumbing system for outdoor lawn watering. Hmm. They have doubled the size of Central Florida, of Orange County, Florida, without having to take any new clean drinking water. All the outdoor lawn watering and soccer irrigation and so forth is done with cleaned up wastewater. It's all, of course, we take our water from the Delaware and the Schuylkill. It's all reuse water. That water isn't quote-unquote pure. It's not virgin water. It's been around for billions of years. And so there's no reason not to reuse water that a community already has and not to take stormwater and find good ways of using it so that it doesn't cost us money but actually expands our water supply rather than being a burden.
And I know that individuals have been buying rain barrels, I guess, to use it for their own personal use to conserve water.
Absolutely. In the Philly metro area and in places that are traditionally lush, the Northeast, certainly except in times of drought, places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, rainwater harvesting right at home, using rainwater barrels to gather water as it falls off your roof and then use it to water your plants and your lawn is absolutely brilliant, and it doesn't take that much effort. You know, if you think about how we've rewired the country for cable TV in the last 30 years and rewired the country for Internet in the last 10 years, a rainwater harvesting barrel is pretty basic technology. And if you put in place those kinds of rules across a community, you know, in the Philly metro area, if all the jurisdictions would cooperate, for instance, and change zoning rules and change building codes so that new construction used rainwater instead of dumping it into the stormwater system. You don't change the water system in a month or a year, but like Central Florida, 20 years from now, the water picture in Philadelphia would look much different. And that's what I'm arguing for. When you have a drought, you have people's attention. So you should grab hold of it and say, you know, there's five things we could do, and when the next drought comes, we won't be in such bad shape.
Well, Las Vegas has had to deal with the fact that it's so dry and arid out there, but they have dramatically reduced water consumption. What can we learn from Las Vegas?
Well, Las Vegas has reduced water consumption by one-third per person over the last 20 years, which is really extraordinary. They have a whole set of rules. They have permanent rainwater, permanent lawn watering rules. So you can only water your lawn at certain hours, and it doesn't matter whether it's rained that season or not. These are the rules that give you enough water to water your lawn. It's illegal in Las Vegas to let sprinkler water hit the road or the sidewalk so that you don't waste water sending it into the storm drain. It's actually illegal now in Las Vegas. Now, this wouldn't happen in the Northeast or the Midwest. It's illegal to have a front lawn if your house was built starting in 2000 because it's a desert and you don't need to cultivate grass. So they have very slowly changed the culture by putting in place common sense rules that very slowly change water consumption.
Let me get Allison from Ballykinwood to join our conversation. Allison, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my question. I wondered what grey water was and if there was a way of sort of incorporating it to a house water management system.
Allison,
sure.
Yeah, go ahead, Charles.
Grey water is traditionally considered shower water and water from a dishwasher, water from a washing machine, water that's dirty but is not sewer water. And there are some communities that let individual homes put in a system to gather the gray water. It's all going into a pipe anyway, so it's not that hard to gather, and run it through a simple filter and then use it to water plants. That's about the limit of what you can use it for. I don't know what the rules specifically in Pennsylvania are. Most U.S. states don't permit homeowners to put in their own gray water systems because we have a long-standing caution about reusing dirty water right at home without somebody paying attention to it. And I think there's a place for gray water systems. There's a place for reusing water right in your own home, but the safest way to do that is to incorporate those systems in new construction or when you renovate, and for the homes we use now to simply rely on rainwater harvesting. Retrofitting an existing home to put in a gray water system that allows you to reuse that water right on site is going to be very expensive. It's certainly not going to save you enough money on your water bill to make sense. But it's part of changing the culture, which is there's nothing wrong with using water a second time or a third time if you're using it for the right purpose.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, and your article is essentially, let's not waste this drought and let's not just conserve and then forget. And this, you know, it's hard to know whether we will continue with these droughts, but do you think the country's ready to make some actual changes about water use?
Well, I really feel like, you know, when I've traveled around the country, people are talking about water more than they were 10 years ago. And an event like this drought, which sort of wakes everybody up, you know, where does the water in Dallas come from? Where does the water in Nashville come from? Where does the farmer get his water? It's just a great moment to push that conversation. And so the point of saying don't waste the drought was to say it to ordinary people, but especially to leaders, especially to the people who run water utilities, companies, Coca-Cola, Intel, IBM, are really taking leadership with their own water vulnerability. And if water leaders, political leaders, local people, and businesses stand up and say, you know, this is important, let's push to make some changes in the system. They won't be painful, but we'll really be glad we did. That's, you know, it's a moment to sort of galvanize people.
Well, on that note, Charles Fishman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times once again.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's the author of The Big Thirst. We have another guest and another topic. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360, the best DJ in the world?
I was against the very straightforward music scene there where it was like one style of music all night long. I had these greater ideas and trying to draw linkages between these different types of music and really push it.
A lesson from a world-class DJ. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
A new school year is just starting. Parents are busy with back-to-school shopping for supplies and clothes, but for some families, this time means more than getting the right markers, notebooks, and folders. We'll talk with the parents of special needs children about how they prepare for the beginning of the year. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Viviana Hurtado.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Vivian Applewhite, one of the plaintiffs in the challenge to Pennsylvania's voter ID law, got her new photo ID last week. This was right after Judge Simpson upheld the new law. But while Ms. Applewhite got what she wanted, there are many leftover questions and some confusion about the law and what happens next. We asked Bob Warner to join us. He's City Hall reporter or writer or staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been covering the story. And Bob Warner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty.
And to our listeners, any questions that you might have, and Bob's going to be with us for the next 20 minutes or so, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Just to recap for our listeners, what did Judge Simpson rule last week? What was his conclusion about this law?
Well, he basically gave the go-ahead for the law to take effect November 6th, requiring people to have specified forms of photo ID in order to get their vote recorded, actually in order for them to vote on the machines. If they don't have the appropriate photo ID, they'll still be allowed to fill out provisional ballots, which will be collected, kept separate, not counted on election night, but the voter would have 6 days to go to the county board of elections, whatever his county seat is, and prove that he was in fact entitled to vote.
Well, the ACLU and others obviously has taken this this ruling to the Supreme Court. Do you know when they're going to rule on that, or at least hear the case?
It's not settled. Everybody expects it to be in September. Actually, the appeal was filed the day after Judge Simpson's decision. The state has until Wednesday, tomorrow, to respond, and then presumably the Supreme Court will set a schedule for dealing with it.
And we should say there are six members of the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania, not the normal seven members.
That's correct. And they're divided 3-3 between Democrats and Republicans, which makes the whole situation pretty closely contended.
And interestingly, it looks like people are watching Justice Ron Castile, I guess because of a vote he had earlier having to do with redistricting.
Yes, he bucked the party, got all the people in the Republican Party upset with him for deciding that the redistricting plan divided too many municipalities unnecessarily. And sent the thing back to the drawing board, and I think it's now awaiting a new redistricting plan is also awaiting Supreme Court action.
A very busy year here in Pennsylvania. Now, what's interesting, when the judge ruled last week, he said to some of the plaintiffs that they could actually vote absentee, that while it might be difficult for them to vote in person, they could vote absentee. Does anyone know how many people vote absentee in Pennsylvania?
I don't know what the statewide figures are. I mean, it runs to several thousand in Philadelphia. And there are really two kinds of ballots. An absentee ballot for people who are going to be out of town on election day or have what would appear to be a temporary illness that makes it impossible for them to go to the polls. There's also what's called an alternative ballot, which is available to people who are disabled or over 65 years old and have a polling place that is deemed to be inaccessible. In Philadelphia, out of 1,600 polling locations, all but 70 are deemed to be inaccessible.
Really?
Largely due to parking problems, I'm told.
What's curious about it, about that part of the ruling, is that while in-person voter impersonation is considered to be extremely rare, absentee voting has a checkered past.
It does, and the new legislation actually puts some restrictions into the absentee voting picture that were not there before. In order to get an absentee ballot, you have to submit an application to get it, and the new requirements are that on the application, you have to list either your driver's license number or the last four digits of your Social Security number, or a copy of an acceptable photo ID, the same document that you'd have to show in order to vote at the polls. So these are new requirements. Once a voter submits his application for the ballot, city election officials will be able to check their driver's license number or their Social Security number against the same information that's supposed to be in their voter registration. So if there's a match there, they'll go ahead and send out the ballot.
Now, I was reading actually in your paper that I think the same day or the day after the judge's ruling, two online sites were taken down, and these were sites that allowed voters to apply for absentee ballots or to register online to vote.
Well, it's a little bit different from that. The state had actually been trying to develop a plan where people could register to vote online or apply for an absentee ballot online, and essentially they announced the day after the decision that they were going to stop that planning process, not implement it with this election, because they felt there was just too much going on. Now, they said that this was provoked by county election officials asking them to suspend the process. I know that Stephanie Singer in Philadelphia said that she had not been consulted about it, and actually she thought this would create a little bit more work for her people in Philadelphia, so she was sorry to see it abandoned.
It would have been more work. It's more work now without these online sites.
Well, the online sites typically are buggy. I mean, that's what the word on these were, and I think Stephanie Singer just felt that this might relieve us of some of the work of handling all of these registration and absentee ballot applications ourselves.
That's Bob Werner. He's a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been covering developments surrounding Pennsylvania's voter ID law, and is getting us up to speed on this issue, something we've been covering quite a bit on Radio Times, but it's a big issue here in the state of Pennsylvania. Any questions or comments you might have, the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Just to underscore and to understand the absentee ballot, do you have to register in person for that, or can you do it over the phone?
You can call up. Most of the county offices have a telephone number that you can call to just ask that the application be sent to you in the mail. Then you need to fill out the application with the appropriate security information. Send that back into your county election officials. They'll send you a ballot. You need to fill that out and then send it in well in advance of the election. It actually has to be received, I believe, the Friday before the election occurs. And there is a potential hazard with using this method, although a lot of people are recommending if you've got any concern about your voter ID, this is what you should do. The concern is that your ballot will be basically set aside put in a secure location by the county election board and not counted until after the machine results are tallied. And if we happen to see a Florida situation in Pennsylvania, God forbid, it was a very close election, having the ballot segregated in this way would make it potentially subject to some legal challenge. And I've talked to a few older voters who would definitely be eligible for the absentee ballot who say, I just don't want to do that. I want to vote on the machine like everybody else.
Now, the Department of State has said that they will provide a new voter ID card, I think, as soon as the end of this month or next week.
Next week, next Monday, it's supposed to make its debut. This was something that the state put forward right before the Judge Simpson was about to begin hearings on the law. And there are still some questions about exactly how it'll work. Supposedly, all you'll need to get it are to just tell the people at PennDOT, what your date of birth is and what your Social Security number is, they'll have a way to check this information and provide you with a photo ID on the spot if your information mm-hmm. checks out.
I guess the question is, this puts a lot of focus on PennDOT and a lot of pressure on PennDOT to be able to get the right IDs to the right people. Do they have the personnel? Do they have the staff? Do they have the – there's 71 licensing centers. It's a big state.
Well, that's right. And there have been problems with this already since March and April when the new law passed, with PennDOT clerks really not being prepared to deal with a new law, not really knowing what the regulations are, asking people for money when the ID is supposed to be free. And then there are limited hours at many of these places. So they'll be open only 3 days a week for limited hours. People will try to get it right, but they'll show up and find out that the place is closed and have to come back, et cetera.
And there are some counties that don't have a licensing center in that particular county.
That's right. This is a 40 or 50 mile drive for some people. And since we're talking essentially about people who don't have driver's licenses, for them to make this trip is going to be a problem. And under the rules that have been set up for some of the alternate ways of getting ID, you've got to make this trip twice. Once to provide PennDOT with the information, and then to come back another time to get your photo taken if the information checks out.
Let me get some callers in. We have, it looks like Barbara from Willow Grove to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for doing this topic.
You're welcome.
I'm very concerned about this. While you were, I have just gone on the website votespa.com to print up the voter registration application. I have probably a very minor thing, but my driver's license does not show my middle initial. My voter registration card does. So I thought, well, I'll just update my registration. But when I go to print it, and this is the new registration, I think, because you have to put your driver's license on it, it's not printing the way it looks on the screen. There's a lot of bars that come up on the right side. So I don't know if you sent this in, if it would be considered a valid application, since it doesn't completely print correctly. I don't. I'm at work. I have a good. I'm pretty computer literate.
Right.
It's a PDF document, so there are tools to convert it to a Word document, but it also asks you to sign up for Acrobat processes. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, Barbara, let me take your call. It's an interesting one. I'm looking straight at Bob Warner here. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think if you can make sure that all the information that the application seeks to get, if you get all that information onto what you print out, I can't imagine that it wouldn't be acceptable. And the state has also put out guidelines that would suggest that one of your IDs having a middle initial and the other one not having it wouldn't be a problem anyway.
Barbara, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just picking up on that, and this is what the state is saying, that names have to match, they have to substantially conform. That's the language that the state is using. What does that mean?
Well, there's some discussion about exactly what that means because it's not defined. The state has put out some guidelines to be distributed to county election officials that provide examples of what they think it means, but they say it's really up to each of the counties to advise your boards of election and all your different polling places how they should interpret this language and how they should deal with the kinds of problems that will come up on election day. So in Philadelphia, that means we'll have close to 1,700 judges of elections, one person for each division.
Like.
Well, with some discretion, I'm sure that most of them will apply common sense, and these situations will be easier to deal with because, after all, the same people will have a photo ID, and you'll be able to look at the photo and see if it matches, and look at an address and see if it matches. So there shouldn't be a lot of controversy. At the same time, these are all officials who are Democrats or Republicans, and it's not far-fetched to think that here and there, there will be people who might not be judicious in the way they apply the standard.
Might not substantially conform. Let me see what Pat from Eagleville has to say. Pat, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm thinking of people who have lost their homes or had to move because of foreclosures and that sort of thing. And even if they have a good license, driver's license, their address will be changed. And that also happens to younger people who have had to move home to the empty nest. What are they going to do about different addresses?
Change of address. Pat, thanks for the call. Bob, do you want to take that?
Well, I believe you're allowed to continue voting at an address even after you leave it for one election. Judges have indicated that that's okay. But theoretically, at least, you should be wherever you are living, re-registering at that address and using it.
Pat, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Earlier in the spring, the state came up with a number. I guess it was even before the vote on this law that about 1% of Pennsylvanians might not have the right kind of identification, and then came out with some other numbers, closer to 10%. Have those numbers been reconciled yet?
They really haven't. The original state estimate was based on a comparison of how many people were counted by the Census Bureau as being over 18 years old, and then comparing that to the number of people who had PennDOT licenses, and there was a gap of about 1%, which is still, you know, pushing 100,000 people. It's no small number. What happened then was the Department of State asked PennDOT to compare the number of people with PennDOT licenses to the actual first and last names and birth dates of people who had PennDOT licenses with people who had voter registration. It was a very sloppy mismatch, it turns out, and The result was 758,000 people statewide were identified as likely not having PennDOT ID. When you actually get in and start trying to call people on that list, as we did at the Inquirer, well over half of the people who supposedly didn't have PennDOT ID actually had it. And the result is those numbers seem to be bad. We can't really rely on them. But the people who are trying to reach out and help those who may need help with voter ID don't have a good list of who needs the help.
Well, to be continued. Bob Warner, thank you for stopping by and talking to us about this important issue. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. WHYY's Ben Harold, waiting in the wings, will be talking about another important issue here in the Delaware Valley. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The WHYY Connections Festival rocks the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. Yola Tango. Frank Turner.
After all, it was rock and roll.
Maps and Atlases.
And the moves that stand still.
The Lawsuits.
I can't wait to get down to Tennessee.
Baby and Achilles. And more. Saturday, September 8th. more at whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret tactics used by the FBI and then-California Governor Ronald Reagan to stop Berkeley's radical student movement in the 60s. We talk with Seth Rosenfeld about the information he uncovered through the Freedom of Information Act after four lawsuits. His new book is called Subversives. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A former skinhead who now preaches love says hate groups are laying low after the Sikh temple shooting, but they will be back. Also, what happens when all the women in a small town in South Carolina get up and leave? All of them, 8 to 82. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane here at WHYY. Last year, WHYY's Ben Harold and the public school notebook's Dale Mezzacapa uncovered a number of suspicious erasures on state education tests in Pennsylvania, raising questions about cheating. The state and the Philadelphia School District have been conducting investigations into more than 50 schools. We've asked Ben to get us up to speed on this evolving story. He's WHYY's education reporter. In fact, you can read his stories at WHYY's Newswork site. And Ben, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Just a quick recap, and even going back, it was about a year ago that you and Dale really uncovered these erasures.
That's right. There was a forensic audit that the Pennsylvania Department of Education had commissioned for 2009 for PSSA, the standardized test in Pennsylvania results, all across the Commonwealth. And it had largely sat unlooked at for a couple of years until we came across it and, you know, started pouring through the files. And what we saw based just on the 2009 results was that there were almost 90 schools across the state covering 38 districts and 10 charter schools that had been flagged for both suspicious erasure marks and for statistical irregularities in their results. Not hard evidence of cheating, but a good indicator of where you should look.
And who had done this forensic audit?
Actually, the company that makes the test, it's a company called Data Recognition Corporation, and they as part of their contract with the Pennsylvania Department of Education, had done this in 2009, but it had actually stopped doing it since then. And after this report came to light in the notebook and WHYY started doing reporting on it, the State Secretary of Education, Ronald Tamales, then asked for a retroactive analysis of 2010 and 2011 PSSA results to be done.
And what you are looking at and what investigators are looking at are these suspicious erasures from wrong to right. Now, we're on the radio, so we can't do a visual, but I think we know what that is. But explain what an erasure looks like then.
Well, I think most people probably remember filling out bubbles on standardized test forms, you know, whether you took the Stanford Achievement Test or whatever it may have been in your home area. And students in Philadelphia and across Pennsylvania fill out similar scanned forms for standardized tests each year. In Pennsylvania, it's in grades 3 through 8 and 11. And so the focus of the cheating investigation now in Pennsylvania has been to look for cases where an unusually, statistically, almost impossibly high number of wrong answers that were filled in initially incorrectly have been erased and changed to the right answer. And what that really provides a look at is instances where it very well may have happened that adults have gone back, erased students' answers and filled them in correct, you know, to put the right answers in.
And how many schools are under investigation as it stands today?
Right now, we know that about 10 districts and charters across Pennsylvania have schools that are still being looked at. In Philadelphia, we know a little more of the details around that. There are 53 school district of Philadelphia schools and 3 Philadelphia charter schools that are still part of the ongoing probe.
And you have gotten your hands on some confidential documents and information. What did you find?
Well, that's right. Initially, the initial reporting that we did that kind of helped spur this whole look along was just based on 2009 results. But we knew that the Pennsylvania Department of Education had gone back and done a similar look for these suspicious erasure patterns in 2010 and 11, but state officials had refused to release them. And the notebook and WHYY and Dale and myself both thought it's very important for people to have an accurate sense of what the scope of the problem is. So we've been trying every way we can figure out to understand how extensive the erasures were in 2010 and 11. We recently obtained documents and information that showed that at most of the 53 schools in Philadelphia, the erasures were widespread, prevalent across multiple subjects and grades across all 3 years.
And just quoting from what you said, the 53 schools were flagged across, as you say, multiple grade subjects and years for extremely high rates of wrong-to-right erasures on some of these answer forms.
And so what state officials have said is that on a typical test answer sheet that a student fills out, there's might be one case where a student has initially filled out the wrong answer, then erases it.
One erasure.
Flags occurred when 10% of students in a particular grade and subject had five or more. So it's a really high threshold for understanding. Statistically, it's almost impossible that it happened by chance.
Wow. Now, another thing was to compare the more recent test results to these previous years, looking at these schools, looking at 2009, 2010, and I guess in 2011.
And so, you know, it might be helpful to kind of think of a specific example of a school here.
Exactly.
So there's F.S. Edmonds Elementary School in Northwest Philadelphia. It's a K-6 school, so it administered the tests in grades 3, 4, 5, and 6 in all of these years. In 2009, in 2010, and in 2011, it was flagged for suspicious erasures in every grade and subject 23 of a possible 24 times. Mm-hmm. So egregious patterns of suspicious erasures. Last year, in 2012, in response to this information, the School District of Philadelphia and the State Department of Education instituted tough new monitoring protocols. So the schools weren't allowed to open their own test exams. Teachers weren't allowed to give the test to their own students. There were monitors throughout the school. And what we saw is that at Edmonds, as one example, test scores plummeted both 50 percentage points in both reading and math. So really just astronomical drops after these tough new security measures were put in place.
And was that the most flagrant example?
It's one of many. And so what we found is that across the 53 schools, there's a number of schools that were flagged every year, every grade, every subject. We saw one school, a high school in North Philadelphia called Philadelphia Military Academy at Elverson, where their 11th grade math scores were 79% of the response sheets had these high threshold of suspicious erasures. After the security measures were put in place, the school's math scores dropped over 70 percentage points.
Have you been able to talk to school officials, these particular schools, for instance, we've been talking about?
Right now, we have not. And so both district and state officials have been extremely reluctant to comment on this, citing an ongoing investigation. They want to preserve the integrity of this. So it's been hard to get on-the-ground information. But that's actually the nature of the investigation as it stands now. So both state officials and district officials have been trying to substantiate what this forensic evidence shows. So you can only really prove cheating through a confession or a firsthand eyewitness account. And you can only get those if you have people on the ground, knocking on doors, asking questions, going to schools, and so forth. And so that's been happening in some schools, but not all 53.
But what's interesting is that erasures by themselves then are not considered examples of cheating.
It is not conclusive proof.
Right, so you need someone to come forward.
That's right. And so we have heard from state officials that there have been some confessions. There is some hard evidence. The Philadelphia Inquirer has reported that there have been two suspensions across the state so far, not in Philadelphia, of administrators and teachers. But right now, what we're trying to get a handle on is how aggressive the state and the school district have been in trying to really get boots on the ground to get these kinds of confessions and firsthand accounts.
And we should say that the School District of Philadelphia is investigating, as is the state.
It's complicated. Of these 53 schools, the state has taken on 11 of them to investigate themselves. And from what we understand, and by all appearances, there have been some pretty aggressive investigations on the ground, and that's where we've heard these reports of confessions and hard evidence. There's an additional pot of 20 schools that the School District of Philadelphia is responsible for investigating itself. By all accounts that we've heard to date, again, no official confirmation, but it's been a pretty limited investigation there. And then there's 22 schools, including F.S. Edmonds, the example that we talked about earlier, where they're really just getting further review of an unspecified nature, but no one on the ground asking questions right now.
And that's WHYY's Ben Harold. He's an education reporter here at WHYY. And he, along with Dale Mizzacapa from the Philadelphia School Notebook, have been investigating allegations of cheating at schools both here in the city of Philadelphia. There's also investigations looking at schools and districts across the state, raising a whole host of questions about erasures and who and what might be responsible. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Now, has the state cleared districts? As you said, there were some almost, 90 schools or 90 districts that were looked at initially?
There were, based on the 2009 report, there were almost 90 schools involved, and we think that that expanded somewhat with the 2010 and 11 report. All told, there were at least 48 districts and charters across the state that were under investigation. 30 of those so far have been cleared. Three had investigations closed, and five have been told they're still subject to monitoring. That leaves 10 districts and charters. Again, this is not just a Philadelphia problem. There are a number of charter schools, and there are a number of other districts across the state, including Pittsburgh Harrisburg, Scranton, Reading, you know, a lot of the larger districts in the state that still are under investigation.
Has this information, though, been made public, or have you had to dig and find it? If a district is essentially cleared, is that information made available to the public?
State officials have publicly announced which districts have been cleared. The scope of the erasure problems in 10 and 11, though, is the information that they have not released publicly, mm-hmm. that we've had to find alternative ways to go about getting.
Apparently, there are several levels of suspicion. One is a Tier 1, a Tier 2, and a Tier 3. What's the difference between those tiers?
The Tier 1 schools are the schools that the state has chosen to investigate itself. So the State Office of the Inspector General has sent folks out to schools, again, asking questions based on this data, trying to get confessions and firsthand accounts. Those are 11 of the schools where there are, you know, pretty egregious erasure patterns and pretty egregious forensic data. But not the only schools where there's those kinds of problems. The Tier 2 schools, again, are the ones that the district is looking at. And then there's this big pot of Tier 3 schools that, as of right now, what we understand is that there's no one on the ground asking questions.
What you wrote in the Newsworks piece was that the evidence of widespread cheating was pretty overwhelming.
In cases where you see consistent patterns of these suspicious erasures in multiple grades and subjects in years, it definitely provides at least a suspicion, a very strong suspicion, that there could have been some kind of coordinated systemic effort to cheat by the adults in the building over time. And it's not an isolated incident that or a statistical aberration.
Looking at those tests, and you know, I remember Will taking tests like that as a kid in school. So you have teachers, you have administrators, there's the district as well. How many hands does a test normally go through? Does anybody know?
Well, I think one of the problems in past years is that the security and monitoring around that process has been relatively lax. And so the test booklets are actually delivered to the buildings weeks in advance, and you know, there are varying levels of security over who has access to them during those times. And then there's the question of who proctors an exam. So if you and I are students in a classroom and we're filling out bubbles, there's an adult or sometimes two adults in the room, monitoring that exam. And then we hand our booklets in and multiple people may have access to those. So what the School District of Philadelphia and other districts around the state have done starting this past spring is try and tighten up that chain significantly. But, you know, suspicious erasures are not the only way to cheat on standardized tests. You can also just tell students the answers, or you can write things on the board. If you're taking the exam and I'm the proctor, I might walk around and, you know, give you a little nudge in the shoulder and shake my head no, that's not a, you might want to rethink that question. I mean, there's all kinds of ways. And really, it seems that the investigation in Pennsylvania has narrowed down to really focus on the erasures, however.
Interesting. And of course, we're talking about what is now called high stakes testing. I mean, schools are evaluated, teachers are evaluated, principals, and even with the Obama administration, testing is still extremely important to the future of the funding of schools.
And I think that's a double-edged sword in many respects. I mean, testing is really the standardized test results are the currency of public education right now. And so the integrity of the results is paramount given the types of decisions that are made. So during this time period, 2009 to 2011, schools have been closed based on these results. Schools have been converted to charters based on these results. Former Superintendent Ackerman received a $65,000 performance bonus in part based on these results. Teachers and administrators have been promoted or sanctioned, and schools have received interventions or supports based on these results. So they are really kind of the bedrock around which a lot of the reform efforts and the public education happens. Mm-hmm. And if they can't be trusted, it raises a whole host of very concerning questions.
And Philadelphia, we should say we're talking about Philadelphia, but also the state of Pennsylvania, a number of districts are under investigation. I think Atlanta is probably most in the spotlight, having to do with allegations and perhaps even evidence of cheating.
Yeah, Atlanta is really the gold standard for how to conduct an aggressive, comprehensive investigation into these type of results. And again, it started in Atlanta with a look at these statistical irregularities and suspicious erasure patterns. But initially, there was a Blue Ribbon Commission locally that was tasked with looking into this, and they found really localized evidence and kind of downplayed the extent of the problem. The governor of Georgia actually got involved after that and took a really hardline stance and said, we're going to get to the bottom of this. So at one point, there were over 50 state investigators on the ground. They conclusively proved cheating in 44 of the 56 Atlanta schools they were looking at, over 178 educators were implicated, 38 principals. There were over 80 confessions. So it really kind of gives a look at when there are a number of resources and kind of a commitment to doing a thorough investigation, that's what it looks like.
And were they erasures? Was it also erasures in Atlanta that raised some red flags?
That's right. There were documented cases of so-called cheating parties where teachers and administrators would get together on the weekend over pizza and erase students' incorrect answers and correct them. So, you know, really, really kind of stunning examples of unethical behavior by the adults in schools.
What's been the response from the state and even the district here in Philadelphia to the kind of work that you and Dale have been doing?
Well, again, they've been reluctant to comment officially on the status of the investigation where it is, citing the fact that it's ongoing. For the School District of Philadelphia, in particular, I think that this is a really challenging thing to deal with. I mean, as you well know, there's a number of, this is just one of about a dozen big problems that they're dealing with. They don't have any money. They're in the middle of a leadership turnover. They've lost about half of their central office administrative staff. So, I think it's been a tall order for them to try and conduct thorough investigations of the schools in their bailiwick on this, given the other challenges that are being faced right now.
Have you talked to the new superintendent, Height, about this issue? Have you had a chance to discuss what you've been doing?
We have not, actually. And I think, this, again, is going to be a big challenge that he's going to have to face as he comes in October 1st. A number of the principals who are implicated by both the forensic evidence and, apparently have confessed based on other reports. As of right now, we don't know of any sanctions that have been taken against any administrators in Philadelphia. So presumably some of these principals may still be leading school buildings in the start of the year. That's going to be a challenge that Dr. Height and the school reform commissioner are going to have to confront.
Well, Ben Harold, I congratulate you and Dale Mezzacapa for the work that you've been doing, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for the opportunity to share.
You're very welcome. And he is WHYY's education reporter, Ben Harold, and he and Dale Mezzacapa from the Public School Notebook have been investigating suspicious erasures, questions, allegations of testing, of cheating on state education tests. And you can read more of Ben's reporting if you go to WHYY's Newsworks site. You can also go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us for this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. We cover